I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Welcome to this podcast of The People's Pharmacy.
You can find previous podcasts and more information on a range of health topics at peoplespharmacy.com.
Many people feel anxious because of political divisiveness and economic uncertainty. Does diet make it worse? This is The People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
In times of stress, a lot of us turn to comfort food to get through a difficult time. For some, it's spaghetti and meatballs. For others, it's grilled cheese with tomato soup. During the pandemic, mac and cheese was especially popular.
Are there foods that can make you feel better for more than a moment? Our guest today is a nutritional psychiatrist.
She says that eating to nourish your gut microbes can make you feel better and improve your mood.
Coming up on The People's Pharmacy, how to calm your mind with food.
In The People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, older people starting blood pressure medications are at a greater risk for falls and fractures. That's the finding from a new study published in JAMA Internal Medicine. The investigators studied more than 29,000 elderly people living in Veterans Administration nursing homes. People who were prescribed antihypertensive drugs were matched with others of similar age who did not get blood pressure drugs. Those who began their blood pressure treatment were more than twice as likely to fall and break a bone in the first month. The risk was 5.4 per 100 person years compared to 2.2 per 100 person years for those not taking blood pressure medications. Patients with dementia and those with higher blood pressure initially were at the greatest risk. The researchers concluded, caution and additional monitoring are advised when initiating antihypertensive medication in this vulnerable population. A commentary in the same issue of the journal notes that dropping blood pressure too quickly among elderly individuals could make them dizzy or unsteady.
Now that we're gradually emerging from the COVID-19 pandemic, public health officials are preparing for the next global health threat. Data being presented at the European Society of Clinical Microbiology and Infectious Diseases in Barcelona, Spain today rates influenza as the most likely pathogen to trigger the next pandemic. Far less likely contenders include an as-yet unidentified pathogen called Disease X, along with SARS-like viruses. Hemorrhagic fever, Ebola virus, Nipah virus, hantavirus, and Rift Valley fever virus are also potential problems, but far and away the experts ranked influenza as their biggest worry. That's because the influenza virus is constantly mutating and circulating around the globe. Some experts state that we have little to be worried about since scientists learned so much from the COVID-19 pandemic. Others, however, point out that people have gone back to their old bad habits, coughing into their hands and then shaking hands with others. Mask wearing has disappeared and is unlikely to make much of a comeback anytime soon.
Scientists are beginning to examine the links between gut microbiome and the risks of neurological diseases like Alzheimer's disease. In a recent study, scientists at the Cleveland Clinic used artificial intelligence tools to sniff out relationships between thousands of metabolites of gut microbes and specific receptors in the brain. These G-protein-coupled receptors interact with a particular metabolite called agmatine. This analysis demonstrates that agmatine can help protect against damage associated with Alzheimer's disease. We don't yet know how people might be able to increase levels of this metabolite if they wished to.
Drug companies increasingly rely upon surrogate markers to obtain FDA approval for their new medications. You can think of these metrics a bit like casino chips. When people gamble, they don't put real money on the poker table. Instead, they buy chips, which they cash in if they win. Pharmaceutical companies frequently create clinical trials that use easily measured outcomes like cholesterol levels, blood pressure, or blood glucose. These surrogate markers satisfy the FDA, but do they predict meaningful clinical outcomes that people care about? A new study this week concludes that most of the popular surrogate endpoints drug companies use for approval are not supported by strong evidence of results that people care about. Whether this shocking conclusion will change the way the FDA evaluates drug trials remains to be determined.
Acid-suppressing medicines such as esomeprazole are widely used for heartburn, gastroesophageal reflux disease, and other digestive disorders. An analysis of data from almost 12,000 people found that those taking these medications are more likely to suffer migraine headache. Those on PPIs like omeprazole are 70% more likely to have a diagnosis of migraine than people not taking such medicines. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. How does the food we eat affect our mood? Have you ever imagined that choosing one meal or another would make a difference in your mental outlook? When doctors think about managing anxiety, diet may not be top of mind, but perhaps the food we eat can influence our emotions.
To find out how, we are talking with Dr. Uma Naidu. She is a Harvard nutritional psychiatrist, professional chef, and nutritional biologist. She's also the founder and director of the first and only hospital-based nutritional and metabolic psychiatry service in the United States at Massachusetts General Hospital. She also serves as the director of nutritional psychiatry at MGH Academy and serves on the faculty at Harvard Medical School, the Harvard Department of Nutrition, and is an instructor at the Cambridge School of Culinary Arts. Dr. Naidu is the author of This Is Your Brain on Food and her latest book, Calm Your Mind with Food.
Welcome back to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Uma Naidu.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Dr. Naidu, you have, I think, one of the most unusual career paths that we've ever heard about in medicine. And we would love for you to tell us a little bit about your journey connecting food and mood for your patients. But first, what in the world is a nutritional psychiatrist?
Thanks. That's always a great question. A nutritional psychiatrist really is someone who is using the science of nutrition paired with their knowledge of the human body. So it's the use of healthy whole foods and nutrients, sometimes supplements, to help improve mental well-being while working alongside any medications that are being prescribed and very important psychotherapies. So nutritional psychiatry is meant to be an additional tool in the toolkit for someone struggling with mental health issues.
Dr. Naidu, you describe in the introduction to your super-duper book, Calm Your Mind with Food, your personal experience. And so I'm hoping, since you've put it in print, you will be willing to share it with our listeners.
Yes, and thanks for asking that. You know, one of the things that I experienced in really helping my own anxiety, the Calm Your Mind with Food, is really about helping the 25% more people in the world that are now suffering with anxiety cope with it, because I certainly was one of them. I was having a lot of success. I had the pleasure of speaking to you both for my first book, This Is Your Brain on Food. And believe it or not, due to its success and getting into this almost a little bit of a hamster in a wheel experience of answering questions and speaking to media and doing wonderful podcasts and radio shows, I was almost getting more anxious and worried despite this being a good thing. That led to several disruptions in how I was eating, in the midst of which I also had a very positive experience where I was invited to a conference and met with the then His Royal Highness Prince Charles. I was invited as one of four physicians. And all of these very good things that were happening in my life almost turned on themselves, making me more anxious and disrupting how I was eating. So when I had to almost catch this in myself, it began to become an experience I wanted to share with others, to almost help one another understand that it's a problem any one of us can face. And sometimes even good experiences, positive things in one's life can leave you feeling anxious and on edge. It's not always a bad thing, what might happen. And some of my experience was really correcting things for myself, which I then put into the book as a protocol to help others. So it was a lived experience and one that I was happy to share if it can help more people.
Well, thanks so much for sharing that. And one other thing that was a very good thing that happened during this time frame, you learned from your oncologist that you are now a cancer survivor, the thriving, rather than having to worry about the cancer, you know, continually that sort of Damocles hanging over you.
You know, that's such an amazing point that you reminded me of, Lynn, because linked to what I just shared, one of the biggest realizations I had, all of these, if I were to say, all of these things are sort of happening simultaneously, all of these good things. But one of the things I was living with without even acknowledging to my conscious mind was this, you know, the sword of Damocles, Pickles, that you mentioned. You sort of wake up every morning not really knowing. You go to a test not really knowing if it might show something that has brought the cancer back. And so when I unexpectedly had this appointment, when it was shared with me that I was in the group that were considered to be surviving this episode and moving on, not needing as close follow-up, you should always get a mammogram, of course, annually, but not needing as close follow-up, I felt this sense of relief hit my body, my soul, my mind, and I also had an uplifting of the anxiety. So it was almost like in my life, several good things were happening and they coalesced around things being corrected in how I was eating, the anxiety lifting, but also this weight of living with the diagnosis, really lightening up. That became important in my movement forward.
Dr. Naidu, I hate to say this, but it seems like we are living in not just average, but super anxious times. Whether it's politics or economics, just the evening news is enough to make most people feel very, very uncomfortable. And then sometimes things happen in our personal lives that just add to that. And if most people go to their family practice physician, a nurse practitioner, perhaps a PA, or even a psychiatrist, the answer is often a drug, a medication, and
yes,
frequently a benzodiazepine, you know, Xanax or Ativan or Valium or fill in the blank.
Right.
You have come up with a different approach. And I just wonder, you know, if someone were to come to you as a psychiatrist and say, I'm feeling really anxious, Dr. Naidu, what should I be doing differently, especially with regard to nutrition? What would you begin to say?
The first part of my assessment, and that's always a great question, because over the course of running and forming my clinic at Mass General, which is the first in the country at an academic hospital, I've really almost honed my approach to helping people. I have realized that due to the uniqueness of the gut microbiome and other factors, that everything is much more personalized than it was even 5 years ago. Based on that, one of my opening questions is, I'm really happy to see that you've come to talk with me. And one of the things, in addition to the long history I'm going to take from you, is there something bothering you about something you're eating, something you're drinking, or something that you're doing in relation to your nutrition? And every single time, that person will tell me that it was, you know, the extra bowl of ice cream that the family began eating during COVID, or as I've heard quite often, I usually would go out before COVID and have a glass of wine with my friends or my spouse on a weekend. Now we're opening a bottle every night to get through the week. Another one was I stocked up on cookies and candy because they were shelf stable and I was afraid I would run out of food. And now they're still in my kitchen cabinet and I keep replenishing them. Usually a person knows, in other words, something that is bothering them. And they may not know how to connect the dots to their anxiety or their mood, but it's bothering them. And I start there because it is a very big motivating factor to help them resolve that. So for ice cream, it could be teaching them an easier recipe for a healthy version of ice cream. With wine, it could be how can we cut back on this in a way that's reasonable for your body and so that you don't run into issues, and how can we change that habit with learning one of the botanicals that you can mix into a really nice-looking cocktail that is completely alcohol-free and low in sugar. Or for the candies and snacks, what can we do to teach you a couple of recipes that will take care of that sweet tooth that you have, so to speak, but be a healthy version than just a piece of candy. And what I find is by starting there, within that week or a few days, someone is calling me, emailing me, reaching out to say, I'm sleeping better, or I'm starting to see I'm turning a corner after months of suffering. And it might be something small that they've noticed, but that becomes very powerful in helping them and helping me design a full nutritional psychiatry plan for them, especially around anxiety.
It sounds like you get it started going in the right direction, and then you can build on that.
Correct. Once you develop the momentum from one positive change, that you see the impact. One of the biggest things I hear about is an improvement in sleep. Many people don't realize that poor sleep was driven by feeling very anxious, not even knowing it. And I hear this quite commonly, and when someone is sleeping and resting better, it is huge motivation for them to want to do so much more. I want to eat more greens every day. I want to start learning how to make a salad. I want to improve the proteins that I eat and stop fast food chicken nuggets and actually start making baked chicken at home. Whatever it might be, people start to really get the momentum for more change.
You're listening to Dr. Uma Naidu, psychiatrist, nutritional biologist, and professional chef. Dr. Naidu is the founder and director of the Nutritional and Metabolic Psychiatry Service at MGH. Her latest book is Calm Your Mind with Food.
After the break, we will learn how we can break unhealthy comfort food habits.
We'll hear about a fellow who discovered how his diet contributed to his panic attacks.
How does the gut microbiome affect anxiety?
Specifically, how do the foods we eat change our brain chemicals?
Sometimes food seems like a good idea, but it has unanticipated consequences. That could be the case for artificial sweeteners.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
This podcast is made possible in part by CocoVia, backed by 20 years of scientific research and the maker of the most proven and concentrated flavanol extract in the market today, CocoPro Coco Extract. Coco flavanols are among the most studied plant-based bioactives today and are clinically proven to promote cardiovascular and brain health for the long term, supporting a strong heart and better memory.
Get 15% off your order of any CocoVia product by using the discount code PPOD15. Learn more at CocoVia, and remember that discount code is PPOD15.
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Well, Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by CocoVia Dietary Supplements. CocoVia Cardio Health is offered in both convenient capsule and powder formats, with each serving containing 500 milligrams of cocoa flavanols to support heart health. More information at CocoVia.com.
Many of us seek comfort foods when we're under stress. Joe loves chicken soup with rice, made the way his mother made it, with lots of garlic and onions, parsnips, thyme, and carrots. Then there's mushroom barley soup, another of his mother's favorites. But I would be remiss if I left out the pistachios, which happen to be favorites with our dogs as well.
And Terry loves chili and popcorn, just the way her dad made them. A little peanut butter and jam also goes a long way when deadlines loom. Oh, and let's not forget the chocolate. A little piece of dark chocolate with almonds is always comforting.
We're talking today with the author of Calm Your Mind with Food. Dr. Uma Naidu is a nutritional psychiatrist, nutritional biologist, and professional chef. Dr. Naidu is the founder and director of the Nutritional and Metabolic Psychiatry Service at Massachusetts General Hospital. She serves on the faculty at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard Department of Nutrition. In addition, she's director of nutritional psychiatry at MGH Academy, an instructor at the Cambridge School of Culinary Arts. Her previous book is This Is Your Brain on Food.
Dr. Naidu, I think a lot of people love carbs. And I have to be honest with you, I love salty, crunchy stuff. I mean, you know, crackers or pretzel thins. Oh, man, they are so good. And if I'm feeling a little anxious, it's like I'll make a beeline to something salty, crunchy, or I might add some peanuts or some other nuts. But I'm wondering, you know, how do you help people break their comfort food habits? Because when people are anxious, they often turn to what they consider to be their comfort foods.
So that's a great question, Joe. I think that one of the ways that I do this, and I work with them in a similar way, it's identifying what that issue is, right? And some people come and saying, my hang up is that comfort food that I'm turning to all the time. And that comfort food is crunchy potato chips and pretzels and crackers. And when I open the box, they're delicious and I can't put them down. One of the things that helps them understand a little bit is also sharing the science around the anxiety and how comfort foods are actually discomfort for the brain, meaning that they disrupt the gut microbiome. Processed, ultra-processed foods can be quite damaging. That doesn't mean that you can't have the occasional bowl of pretzels or some snacks. No one wants you to ever give up things that you enjoy because that, to me, leads to less joy. And I think that that becomes a problem. But understanding that there may be alternatives you can make, you can try, you can buy, it can be very helpful to people. So crunchy kale or spinach chips made in an air fryer that takes 8 to 10 minutes can be a really easy, quick, crunchy fix made with actual whole foods, spiced to your liking or flavored to your liking. Another one is basically helping you switch that out with, say, a crunchy granola. Say you had more of a kind of a sweet feeling around crunchy foods. It's so easy to make a granola from actual whole foods and nuts and seeds, as well as coconut flakes, and drizzle it and control the amount of honey you add to it so it's not the ones from the supermarket, which tend to be drenched in sugar. So that's another one that becomes an alternative. And helping people design snacks that they will enjoy, even making a seed cracker, which is pretty simple, doesn't involve a lot of processed ingredients, can be quite simple to do. And when people learn these things, they make batches of them at home and have that little snack on hand. But what also happens is because they're not eating eggs or bowls of the unhealthy stuff every day, the gut microbiome over time starts to heal. So I find that when we're replacing it with a healthy snack, they're eating less of it and they're moving on to an apple or, you know, a small bowl of nuts or some other snack at the next time that they're feeling peckish. So this becomes really almost a slow and steady way of adapting our diet, because that one healthy habit really becomes a gateway to more healthy habits and building upon them.
Dr. Naidu, I wonder if you could walk us through a little bit how you would approach a problem that presents as a psychiatric problem, panic attacks, and how you diagnosed the actual problem in one case that you describe in your book. You write about a man named Adi who was having panic attacks while he was walking his dog. And when you spoke with him, he let you know that his mother had died and the previous year. So, of course, he was still pretty engulfed by grief. But what was really bothering him was the panic attacks. How did you unravel that? And what did it have to do with his diet?
That's such a great question, Che. Thanks for asking. So with Adi, I initially thought this was a grief response. It seemed natural. His mother had passed. He was, having these panic attacks as he was walking his dog. And I initially connected it to sort of a more complicated grief reaction because it was a year later. But as I spoke with him and understood, and this is always speaks to the importance of taking a history and clinical care, understanding someone's background, he then went on to describe what he was doing in his life. And he told me that his mother, his late mom, was a fantastic cook, and she always cooked with fresh ingredients and had a little herb garden, and he enjoyed delicious meals. And this was something he looked forward to every single day. But when she passed away, he was left without the knowledge of how to cook or prepare foods. And he began to use a food delivery, apps that brought him a fast food meal within 10 minutes. He began to order from local restaurants. And he did say to me that although he had been a healthy eater, he was now craving different comfort foods and ordering things that he had not usually been eating because his mother cooked really good foods. And as I outlined it, he'd been doing this for several months, pretty much since she had passed away. And it correlated with the onset of symptoms of anxiety. And what I uncovered with him was that he had been, for want of a better description, really eating fast foods for the almost a year following his mother's passing away. And this had disrupted his gut microbiome. And he was super anxious, experiencing these panic attacks. He was eating sugary foods, which are feeding the wrong gut microbes. Once we identified it, it is quite, it took work, but he was able to understand that this was something he could fix. And he was feeling such severe panic that it was easy to work with him to start to, over time, help him with healthier meals. And eventually he enrolled in some cooking classes, which not only built a sense of community around him, but also taught him some healthy cooking lessons that he could use.
I can just imagine some of our listeners saying, the gut microbiome, what does that have to do with anxiety?
So true. And the way that we eat really does impact the way that we feel. The neuroscience of the gut microbiome has emerged over the last several decades, although Hippocrates, the father of modern allopathic medicine, spoke to this connection, but the science, as I say, had to follow. I often ask people, Terry, what happens when you have a headache? And they might say, well, I wait for a bit, and then I eventually, if it's too bad, I take a headache pill. And then I push them, and I say, well, what do you do with it? And I roll their eyes and say, well, of course, I get a glass of water, I swallow the pill, and I hope my headache goes away. And then I ask them to stop for a second and say, but you're swallowing a pill that's going, for one of a better explanation, to your gut and to your stomach, but the pain's in your head. How do you explain that? And, they look at me puzzled. And then I say and start to unfold how food and a similar and more complex pathway is broken down. It is broken down in the gut by the trillions of microbes that live there. Just like the headache pill is metabolized and reaches your neural or the tissue in your brain to relieve that headache, in a similar way, in a more slow and complex way, food and nutrients are broken down by the gut microbes. And when you're eating healthier foods and healthier options, like Adi had learned to prepare when he went to those healthy cooking classes, the gut microbes are nurtured and taken care of, and your gut microbiome is not inflamed. But for the most part, many Americans eat a standard American diet, a diet that's quite rich in ultra-processed, processed packaged foods and fast foods and highly sugared foods. And when we do that, the bad microbes are nurtured. They love sugar and these unhealthy foods. And when they thrive, they cause inflammation in the gut. When inflammation in the gut microbiome is caused, this leads to damage of the lining of the gut and leakage of toxic substances into the blood system. And over time, this inflammation really increases and drives upon itself and can lead to more negative impacts in the body. So ultimately, what we want to do is fend off inflammation and prevent that from happening. Because what I see in individuals is if they continue to eat the unhealthy foods, they may appear with severe anxiety, such as panic.
Dr. Naidu, if we were to gather together a bunch of your colleagues, psychiatrists at Harvard, and ask them about neurochemistry, they would be very comfortable talking about serotonin and dopamine and histamine and a bunch of other transmitters, noradrenaline, adrenaline. If we mentioned that, those are important neurotransmitters in the brain, but there's a lot of serotonin in the gut, they would probably look at us with a little puzzle expression on their faces, because I think most health professionals sort of think of the brain as being separate, isolated from the digestive tract. And the idea that there are neurotransmitters in the digestive tract that might have an impact on the brain, that just seems counterintuitive. How do you explain that to your colleagues? And how do the foods we eat impact our brain chemistry?
So it turns out that the amount of serotonin in the gut does translate to getting to the brain, but it needs a little bit of help crossing that blood-brain barrier. And one of the ways that happens is through the foods that we consume. And one of those foods are tryptophan-rich foods like turkey or even chickpeas. And understanding this more complexly becomes super important. And also like to point out, just for the sake of helping the listeners understand, that even though modern psychiatry focuses a lot, and the medications that are prescribed focus a lot on the serotonin hypothesis, a very important research study published in the British Medical Journal within the last 2 years really questioned the serotonin hypothesis. And that does not mean that people taking an SSRI medication, an antidepressant, should stop ever taking their medications without discussing it with their doctor. But what the scientific paper shared is that there may be more to the picture than just the serotonin. So I also felt it's important to share that here, because it is so many things, and food actually interacts with all of those things.
Well, I'm so glad you brought up that serotonin hypothesis issue, because we, in fact, have spoken with one of the British psychiatrists who has done that kind of research.
Fantastic.
And points out the fact that it's a lot more complicated than we used to think. Just take Prozac and it'll fix everything.
Correct.
But the idea that the foods we eat can have a profound impact on this multifactorial system that affects our mood, that affects our brain, that affects the way in which these chemicals interact with each other, is, I think, a really critical factor. I do want to segue from that to this issue of how some of the foods that we eat can have a negative impact. And in particular, I'm thinking about artificial sweeteners. Most people don't think twice about artificial sweeteners, and yet I suspect that they may have an impact on our neurophysiology.
Artificial sweeteners are added to so many foods labeled as low sugar, no sugar, sugar-free, but they can actually be very disruptive to the gut microbiome. So there are a few newer sweeteners that are still being tested and evaluated through research, but for the most part, those found in things like diet soda and other foods, especially candies, can be quite a problem. Now, these artificial sweeteners are also called non-nutritive sweeteners. And what that really is saying by the word and what it implies is that it's not offering nutrition, but it's offering this sweet taste. And when people, consume a lot of artificial sweeteners, it actually might drive cravings to eat more food and actually can disrupt their metabolism. And the reason is that when you have something that is really very hyper-sweetened, think of a small packet of artificial sweetener and think of a teaspoon of sugar. You're actually taking in very little of that powder, but it's super sweet. And what they do is they kind of confuse the receptors in our body. And the body thinks, you know, you're eating something sweet, sugar is coming, and actually moves sugar in the opposite direction and unfortunately tricks the body because the sugar does not arrive. And what happens is this drives cravings and hunger. So the body wants more food. And often people who are drinking diet sodas or consuming artificial sweeteners in different ways end up potentially gaining weight and disrupting their metabolism. So artificial sweeteners are problematic on several different levels. My suggestion and guidance to my patients is usually, you know, have it once in a while. But, you know, if you drink tea and you happen to drink 6 cups of tea a day and it's a calming tea, if you're adding artificial sweetener to all that tea, that could be disrupting and driving your anxiety versus the tea itself, which you're using to help calm yourself.
You're listening to Dr. Uma Naidu, Harvard psychiatrist, professional chef, and nutritional biologist. She's also the founder and director of the Nutritional and Metabolic Psychiatry Service at Massachusetts General Hospital. It's the first such service in the United States. Dr. Naidu is also the director of nutritional psychiatry at MGH Academy and serves on the faculty at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard Department of Nutrition. In addition, she's an instructor at the Cambridge School of Culinary Arts. She's the author of This Is Your Brain on Food, along with her latest book, Calm Your Mind with Food.
After the break, we'll hear about a person struggling with weight loss, even though she was following the guidelines carefully.
What does Dr. Naidu think about the weight loss drugs that have become so popular lately?
You know what we're talking about. Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, and Zepbound. I've already confessed that when I'm anxious, I tend to snack and I'm not alone. How does anxiety fuel bad food choices?
How can we interrupt that vicious cycle?
We'll find out how to create an anti-anxiety eating plan.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
This podcast is brought to you in part by Urea Skin Relief from The People's Pharmacy. After years of work, we've gotten the formula just right. We're delighted to be offering this intensive skin therapy with 20% urea.
Urea Skin Relief Cream is not your average moisturizer. Formulated with a unique blend of urea and plant-based ingredients, it's specifically designed to deeply hydrate and soothe even the most stubborn dry skin. Whether you're battling the effects of harsh weather or you have sensitive skin that's prone to irritation, this cream works wonders.
Urea is a powerhouse ingredient. Not only does it act as a humectant, drawing moisture into the skin, it also beefs up the skin's barrier function. We're just as proud of what you won't find in our Urea Skin Relief Cream, no parabens or phthalates. creating a cream for dry skin free of these common endocrine-disrupting preservatives and plasticizers was what motivated us to make this product.
We're offering a limited-time discount for People's Pharmacy podcast listeners. You can get 20% off either the handy 2-ounce size or the hefty 6-ounce size of the People's Pharmacy Urea Skin Relief. You'll find them both in the body care section of the store at peoplespharmacy.com.
Make sure you put the code PP20 into the discount code box when you check out. That's capital P, capital P, PP20 for 20% off your urea skin relief purchase through May 31, 2024 at peoplespharmacy.com.
Welcome back to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by CocoVia Dietary Supplements. Cocoa flavanol supplements that support cognitive and cardiovascular health. Made with proven concentrated flavanol extract. More information at CocoVia.com.
I know we've mentioned Joe's Good and Plenty story before, when he would travel and get anxious about a late flight, he'd head for the candy counter. But it serves as a reminder that sometimes we make counterproductive choices under stress. He used to think that eating a box of Good and Plenty licorice candy would make him feel less anxious, but it always made him feel worse after, half an hour or so. How does our guest deal with that kind of vicious cycle?
We are talking with Dr. Uma Naidu. She is a nutritional psychiatrist, nutritional biologist, and professional chef. Dr. Naidu is the founder and director of the Nutritional and Metabolic Psychiatry Service at Massachusetts General Hospital. She serves on the faculty at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard Department of Nutrition. In addition, she is director of nutritional psychiatry at MGH Academy and instructor at the Cambridge School of Culinary Arts. Her books are This Is Your Brain on Food and her latest, Calm Your Mind with Food.
Dr. Naidu, one of the stories in Calm Your Mind with Food is about a woman who had been struggling with her weight, and I think a lot of people can relate to that problem. As she had done a group weight loss program at work, and that had helped at first, but she hit a plateau and she started feeling very anxious. The things that she had been doing before to help her anxiety, things like Zumba or hip-hop dance classes, weren't working anymore. And she came to see you. So obviously the first thing you did was you checked her food diary. And what you found was that even though she was following the guidelines for her weight loss group, a lot of the things she was eating were actually sweet treats. Some of them were artificially sweetened. Some of them had sugar in. But even though they met the weight loss guidelines, they really weren't doing her any good. Can you explain that, please?
That's a great way to actually segue into this, because what was happening is she was following these dietary guidelines very closely. She was, counting her calories, measuring things out, all good, healthy habits to guide weight loss. But she had this plateau, as you pointed out, and she couldn't get past it, and she couldn't understand. She was exercising, continuing to do whatever she had been trying to do, but it wasn't working. But as we uncovered her food diary, she was buying these special made-for-the-program candies and treats that were sweet, but they were within the guidelines of the program. And this was actually setting off the lack of her ability to lose weight, because they had a lot of artificial sweeteners. And some of them, even though they might be low calorie, still had high sugar in them. And when we uncovered this, I asked her if we could take those snacks that she was eating every single day and replace them with actually whole food snacks. So teaching her to make an ice cream made with actual fruit. You're having her use foods like a little piece of date or a piece of extra dark chocolate with an orange. Also just something that you can get used to but enjoy instead of these, let's say, weight loss approved treats. And as we started to build in food that was sweet but naturally sweet, she over time, between, I think it took us about 3 weeks for her to notice, because it her body responded in that way. One thing that happened was she did notice almost within the first 5 to 10 days that anxiety was lower. And the next thing she noticed was that a number on the scale started to budge. And that was very significant, because just by cutting out all the weight loss program approved sweets that she bought from them, she was able to then make that change and get off that plateau, and her anxiety improved.
Dr. Naidu, you have described ways to help people change their eating behavior. And you talk in your book a lot about foods that can be calming rather than anxiety producing. But we are living in what I would call the pharmaceutical age of instant gratification. And by that, I mean Ozempic, Wegovy, Zepbound, all these GLP-1 agonists that are supposed to be the magic bullet that will help people lose weight very quickly, very effectively, without changing anything else. Just take the shot and you're home free. And I'm just wondering your thoughts about this sort of paradigm shift. Well, there is now a magic wand. That's all we need to do. We take the shot, and we don't have to think about food anymore. We won't be obsessed by it. We won't just eat very modest amounts of food, maybe, you know, half what we used to eat, and feel completely satisfied. I'm sure some of your colleagues at Harvard have embraced the weight loss pill approach or the weight loss injection approach, without really thinking very much about the fundamentals of the food choices.
You know, I think that this is a complicated one, and I'd like to offer a two-part answer to it. The first is that my one concern about Ozempic and the other weight loss drugs and pharmaceuticals being used off-label, meaning in individuals who don't necessarily have type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance or problems with significant weight, where they really desperately need something to help their weight loss journey, is that there isn't then enough medication available for those truly in need. So the off-label use in that instance does seem somewhat unfair to the people who genuinely, for their health and survival, need it versus someone wanting to lose 20 pounds. That being said, I think that there are many people who have lived with the shame of weight gain in private or public lives that have endured the mental torment of that, and they're looking for a solution. And I think that where it's evaluated by a physician and given in a way that is responsible and not just someone trying to use it to really get rid of the weight without encouraging proper healthy eating habits and things like that, it can become problematic. There are also foods that act in a way with the same impact of the weight loss injections, which are actually, in other words, these foods almost are like the natural hormone of GLP-1, and they are released with certain foods, and these foods are actually satiating and keep you feeling satisfied. Things like nuts, eggs, high fiber foods, avocado, and especially the fermentable fibers and things like vegetables and whole grains, you know, feed our gut bacteria, then which then produce short-chain fatty acids, which are able to trigger GLP-1 secretion. So there are ways to actually quite cleverly do this by adjusting to healthy eating habits. The second part of my answer has to do with the fact that there have also been studies that have shown that use of Ozempic in certain patient populations, like in diabetes, actually can help improve anxiety. And to me, of course, that is important because you're also then helping another symptom, which could help heal that person overall. And there have been some anecdotal studies and information that the medication helps reduce cravings. And that is often also a driver of unhealthy eating, in addition to genetics, environment, and all the other factors that we know about in obesity. So I think that Ozempic and these weight loss medications are complicated, but I think that there are a lot of, I think the ongoing research will also show some interesting maybe mental health benefits that we are not aware of just yet.
Dr. Naidu, you quote Janice Kiecolt-Glaser, who is a research psychologist, I believe, and she's saying that anxiety drives poor dietary choices, and then our bad diet increases inflammation, and then the inflammation ratchets up our anxiety, and then the whole thing just starts spinning out of control. How can we interrupt a vicious cycle like this?
You know, I think that it's multifaceted, and the approach has to be that as well. Firstly, it's identifying that this is a problem and that we are sort of struggling in this vicious cycle of not being able to catch ourselves. I speak about an integrated and holistic approach. In other words, I refer to the Power 9 from the Blue Zones region and the studies there. The fact that having a sense of community, having a sense of purpose, making sure that you are not, that while nutrition is one pillar, you're also paying attention to exercise, outdoor time, breath work, meditation, mindfulness, all of this becomes hugely important. I will often walk people through a mindfulness exercise, teach them a breath work exercise, you know, breath work yoga, pranayama yoga has been shown in research to improve depression and anxiety in a study published early in 2020. So they were testing cardiac disease and actually found that depression and anxiety improved as well. Finding a way through breath work, meditation, mindfulness, an approach to that craving and what you are leaning into to almost inhibit or change the behavior associated with it can be very powerful. And it interrupts that cycle. So you might then be able to think of a healthy option for that food that you're craving or the habit that you're enduring to change it and to adjust to a healthier norm at that point. And that becomes a very powerful tool that someone can use in their fight against anxiety and improving their overall mental well-being.
How do you help your patients build an anti-anxiety eating plan?
Well, first and foremost, I have to ask them what they enjoy eating because I really believe in being open to the different dietary patterns that my patients enjoy. So someone might be vegetarian, someone else may be, you know, lean heavily into fish. Someone else might like all types of meat and may not be eating enough vegetables. So it's about finding that healthy balance and taking the dietary pattern that they eat and really enhancing it for an anti-anxiety plate. But very simply, the way I visually think of an anti-anxiety plate, while putting in foods that people really love to eat and encouraging some new and exciting foods that would improve their mental well-being over time, is I want them to think about 50% of the plate being leafy greens and lots of colorful vegetables that I like to call the kaleidoscope of colors, because there are so many hues, so many colors, and thereby so many micronutrients, phytonutrients involved that can help their body. So a good piling of those which are both satiating and usually quite low in calories. Then the remainder of the plate should be divided up between healthy fats, things like nuts, seeds, avocado or olive oil, as well as a clean protein. And by that, I mean, maybe it's a pasture-raised chicken, maybe it's pastured eggs, maybe it's non-GMO, organic tofu, or lots of beans and legumes that someone on a more vegetarian diet may be consuming. And then the last component of that is some form of healthy whole grain. Some of my favorites include a small serving of really nicely seasoned quinoa or some other grain that's made from the actual grain itself than a processed version. So unlike the food pyramid of several decades ago, where we had the largest part of the food pyramid being the whole grains and starches, it's actually quite inverted on this plate. But what I find is that people are satiated. They are eating anxiety-busting ingredients and nutrients throughout in that plate. And it's a way to visualize thinking about it.
We are big proponents of breakfast. So what would an example, admitting that there are multiple examples, what would one example of an anti-anxiety breakfast look like?
So an anti-anxiety breakfast, in my opinion, there's several choices that I like to go for, but one is a chia pudding because the chia seeds are rich in short-chain omega-3 fatty acids, rich in protein and fiber, simple, easy to make ahead, and very filling because that both the fiber and the protein content. You can also top it with a few blueberries and some nuts and seeds for added nutrients. Another one is pastured scrambled eggs, but adding in lots of veggies. So it might be spinach, it might be chopped peppers, whatever you like is a great one. And you can do the equivalent with making a scramble or an omelet using chickpeas. And you use chickpea flour, same veggies, and have a similar result just made from a different ingredient. Another favorite that I like is a homemade granola. Again, using whole food ingredients, different nuts, different seeds, unsweetened coconut flakes, sweetening it on your own, and having that with, say, a plant-based milk of your choice as a crunchy, and I say cereal with air quotes in that, because it's really a whole food granola you're eating. So different things that might appeal to a different palate. Also, you know, taking a batch of the, say, pastured eggs, or I do the same with chickpea flour and having that baked into mini quiches using a cupcake pan gives you a lot of small servings for breakfast on the go. And these just become ways that people can make sure that that first meal of the day is satiating, healthy, and filled with the right nutrients that their brain and body need to get through the morning.
Dr. Uma Naidu, thank you so much for talking with us on the People's Pharmacy today.
Thanks so much, Terry and Joe. It was great to speak to you both.
You've been listening to Dr. Uma Naidu, Harvard psychiatrist, professional chef, and nutritional biologist. She's also the founder and director of the Nutritional and Metabolic Psychiatry Service at Massachusetts General Hospital. It's the first such service in the United States. Dr. Naidu is also the director of nutritional psychiatry at MGH Academy and serves on the faculty at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard Department of Nutrition. She's the author of This Is Your Brain on Food, and her latest book is Calm Your Mind with Food.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show, Al Wodarski engineered, Dave Graydon edits our interviews, BJ Lederman composed our theme music.
This show is a co-production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, with the People's Pharmacy.
The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by Cocovia Dietary Supplements. Cocovia Memory Plus is formulated with 750 milligrams of cocoa flavanols, a level clinically proven to improve three different types of memory and support brain function. More information is available at cocovia.com.
Today's show is number 1,383. You can find it online at peoplespharmacy.com. And that's also where you can share your comments about today's interview. If you wish, you can reach us through email, radio@peoplespharmacy.com.
Our interviews are available through your favorite podcast provider. You'll find the show on our website on Monday morning.
At peoplespharmacy.com, you could sign up for our free online newsletter to get the latest news about important health stories. When you subscribe, you also have regular access to information about our weekly podcast, so you can find out ahead of time what topics we're covering.
In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next week. Thank you for listening to the People's Pharmacy Podcast. It's an honor and a pleasure to bring you our award-winning program week in and week out. But producing and distributing this show as a free podcast takes time and costs money.
If you like what we do and you'd like to help us continue to produce high-quality, independent healthcare journalism, please consider chipping in.
All you have to do is go to peoplespharmacy.com/donate.
Whether it's just one time or a monthly donation, you can be part of the team that makes this show possible. Thank you for your continued loyalty and support. We couldn't make our show without you.